This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Chad Whalen. Chad is the CEO of Banner University Medicine in Tucson. Tucson, of course, a beautiful place. And Banner Healthcare, one of the great regional systems in the country that has grown and improved so much over the last decade plus and more. I want to talk to Chad today about Banner University Medicine, about shortages of physicians, and a lot more. Dr. Whalen, can you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Sure. So Chad Whalen, I'm a general internist and hospitalist by training. I've been in academics my whole life. I've been down here in Tucson for about 2 years, came from the Midwest, primarily Chicago. Married, have three kids, two are adults in Chicago, and one little one who's still with us in Tucson.
Well, fantastic. And did you not miss the Chicago winters, January and February here? Are you happier there during those months?
It is beautiful here in Tucson, sunny skies, although I have to admit I do love a good winter day.
Well, fantastic. Talk to us about Banner University of Medicine and a few points of pride and sort of how it ties into Banner Healthcare and the great system that Dr. Fine and crew have built.
Yeah, absolutely. So Banner Health, very large, originally a hospital system, but really now a healthcare delivery system. Banner University of Medicine in Tucson is a partnership between Banner Health and the University of Arizona, and really bringing together the two great organizations to deliver on the promise and I think the possibility of academic medicine coupled with a regional health system. So Banner University of Medicine Tucson, what is that? It's two acute care hospitals. So one is the Tucson campus, which is the traditional academic medical center, has a children's hospital as part of it. The other hospital is a community hospital, formerly was a county hospital, but now serves a community hospital perspective, but has a very large behavioral health component to it as well. We also have about 20 clinic sites that span three counties across southern Arizona, and these range from small primary care community-based clinics to very large multi-specialty clinics with advanced imaging and advanced diagnostics. We have a clinical cancer center that's associated with the University of Arizona Cancer Center. And then the final component is the medical group. So it's Banner University Medical Group, which is made up of University of Arizona faculty and all of the associated GME programs. It's a level one trauma center. We do transplant. We have the children's hospital, cancer care, et cetera. So that's sort of historically what is Banner University Medicine Tucson. Now, they've traditionally run kind of separate, two hospitals, the clinics, the medical group. They've been related but functioned independently. And over the past 2 years, we've been transforming that approach to bring them, all under one umbrella with the goal of providing a highly coordinated, integrated delivery system across southern Arizona. A couple things, a pride for sure recently, and this will be a recurring theme, is the COVID response. I just have to call out our people here. They have just done a phenomenal job, as people have around the country, to show up and, with all the uncertainty, is to just keep taking care of people and both who have COVID and then also figuring out how we safely take care of all the people who don't. Been down here for 2 years, and the people who work here and their commitment to this place, this community, and healthcare, it is truly phenomenal. It's a commitment not just to the patients, but really to the broad community. And something that was new to me was the incredible diversity that of people that call Southern Arizona home, and to be able to serve that community has been just remarkable.
And talk for a moment about your career journey and how you ended up where you're at today at Banner University Medicine and so forth.
Sure. So this is not a role I ever imagined or aspired to be when I started out in medicine. And in fact, I went to college with express desire of not becoming a physician. So best laid plans, obviously. I started out as going to be a history or music major and fell in love with science and curiosity. So then I was going to be a basic scientist and went to medical school to ask better questions and got to residency. And I just was transformed. Literally, my life was changed by caring for patients, and it made me rethink a lot of things. So I started off in primary care and academics. So really spending the next 20 years as a primary care doc, and then became a hospitalist in academic medicine, going from University of Michigan to University of Chicago and then to Loyola. And really, the path to here is I found that I got frustrated when the systems didn't work. And I thought, you know, I could either complain about them, figure out workarounds, or try and fix it. And I chose the latter. And I learned that I really enjoyed fixing the system, and that, you know, I could affect far more patients that way than ever could as a doctor taking care of a single patient at a time. And so then I started to think about, okay, instead of just fixing those things that frustrated me, what if we imagined, you know, fixing the delivery system at large? And that's sort of how I transitioned over. So the opportunities and problems got larger in scope, and I went from, you know, roles as medical director, division director, CMO, and then right before this, I was president at Loyola University Medical Center. And then I came down here 2 years ago to really oversee that market that I described, bringing the hospitals, the clinics, and the faculty medical group all under one. And that's what I'm excited to be able to do every single day.
Fantastic. So, University of Chicago versus University of Michigan, do you think yourself as more of a maroon or a Wolverine, or neither?
That is a great question. So I have to say, you know, when I'm rooting for sports teams, I have to go with a Wolverine. But the piece that resonates with me is, you know, University of Chicago's sort of intellectual curiosity. There's just something about that place that's pretty special.
Dr. Whalen, thank you so much. Take a moment. We're in a situation where it seems like shortages of physicians in the long run, shortages of clinicians of all sorts, seems like a looming debacle in our country. Any thoughts on how that's solved? Any thoughts on how we address that as a nation and in its areas?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one I wish I had all the answers for. But let me give you some thoughts. Note that, you know, this was important a year ago, but it's even more pressing now, and certainly more visible an issue because of the pandemic. You know, how we got here and how we get out of this is complicated, but there are two points that I think are worth considering through all of this. So first off, clinicians, our professional identity is really tied to that one-on-one relationship with patients, and it's true for nursing and for physicians. And I think that's critical to think about how we preserve that relationship, because it's what drew us into our calling, but also recognize that that inherently risks slowing innovation and change. Second, it's historically a field that has very strong professional organizations that represent physicians, APNs, nursing, and these organizations have tried to hold on to their current roles and regulations to support, you know, quote unquote, their turf. And I think the flaw here in that one is that there's actually more than enough work to go around. And as technology and needs change, I believe that the scope of practice really needs to adapt. So, having said all that, I think there's four sets of activities: retention, the pipeline, redesigning the system, and then I'll leave with sort of an aspirational idea that, I think could be kind of interesting. So first, let me start with retention. Certainly more now than ever. You know, before COVID, burnout was high. Physicians got the most attention, but we know is very high in nursing as well. And now with COVID, we've just seen a flood of people leaving the profession, especially on nursing, but also on the provider side as well. So how to address that? It's relatively challenging, but I think first and foremost, we need to make people's lives easier. We've added so many technology advances, but many of them have actually made day-to-day, minute-to-minute work harder for their providers. And then the second piece we really need to do is remember that people chose us for a calling. And so we need to tie everything back to that professional identity and the higher purpose that is medicine. We need to think about being flexible with hours and roles as people's lives change and their priorities change. And importantly, as a leader, we need to show people that they're valued every single day and we really do care about them. Second thing we need to do is improve the pipeline. I think it's a little bit different story with physicians and nurses. physicians, you know, medical school remains highly competitive. People want to go to medical school, and the medical school numbers are increasing, and that's good. Shortening pathways, I think that might provide a little bit of easing, and we should do it where it makes sense. I think really the big lever here is on the GME funding mechanism. I think it needs revamping. It's a system that's, you know, fixed by historical numbers, heavily skewed towards hospital-based programs, and it doesn't really have the ability to drive trainees toward where we actually need them. You know, it's a major national investment in training, and I think that absolutely makes sense. But with that investment, and, you know, here I am one of the receivers of that investment, I think the investors should have the ability to demand flexibility and look for production outcomes that make those massive dollars a wide investment to our national delivery system. So what do I mean by that? You know, our total numbers of physicians today are not the world's highest per capita, but we're in the ballpark of most European countries. But we don't have the right spread. And so I think if you take a city, I think New York City is a fantastic example. Overall, has a very high physician to population ratio. But yet, from a primary care perspective, it's vastly underserved. And so we have this disconnect of too many physicians concentrated in small places and really not the distribution of types of physicians we need. And so as you address the GME funding to be able to incentivize both geographic and specialty spread, I think that'd be helpful. I think nursing's a little bit different.
Go ahead. Talk about this for a second, because what's happened is if you look at, you know, a generation ago or more so, doctors either coming out of the military or coming here for whatever reason, immigrating here, went to all these small and mid-sized towns throughout the country on all kinds of different programs. Now, we are in a period of time where more and more, everybody moves more and more to the larger cities versus the smaller cities. And so not only do you have this problem in big cities where they might have too many specialists per capita, but I don't believe that's the case, but you're well underserved in primary care. If you take that out to mid-sized and small-sized cities, the problem is much more pervasive, both on specialties and non-specialists, isn't it? I mean, it's really tremendous shortages, and you're seeing that now in COVID in the plain states. They don't have enough nurses or doctors as we get
absolutely
into, you know, horrible period of time.
Absolutely, and I think you know what drives it is there's financial drivers that certainly pull that, but there's also you know, a lot of people coming out of residency want to live in the same cities everyone else wants to live in, and they have their choice to be able to do it. So until we sort of tackle that and tie GME funding to those sorts of outcomes to actually, you know, incentivize through lots of different ways to do it, and I am certainly not the expert on the best method of incentivizing and or mandating distribution of, you know, physicians. But if we just rely on people being able to go wherever they want to go to, we're going to continue to see that. And I think we need to take a little bit more of a control perspective in terms of, you know, setting up incentives for people to move to mid-size and small markets and to increase our primary care to specialty ratio.
We just need to increase that bandwidth. But it's not even, it's increasing the ratio. But at the end of the day, we need more specialists too. I mean, it's easy to talk about how we need a better ratio of primary care to specialists. And certainly in small and mid-sized towns, you're starting to come to the big cities for some specialties. But generally, no matter who you are, unless you have a connection, it's hard to get the right specialist. But primary care, the problem's endemic. But isn't it the case that, you know, people that immigrate here are still more likely to go to these small towns and strengthen these small town medical communities? And so thank goodness for that part of the pipeline. And then when you look at it, and people that grew up in those towns are a little more likely to go back. But now when people get out of residencies, between the husband and the wife, between the spouses, you got to have both of them wanting to go to a smaller mid-sized town. And as you said, without more incentives, there's just not enough people that want to do that. They'd much rather gravitate towards you know, either physician or their spouse to the bigger cities. Yeah. And so how do we, is there a way, is it too hard to become a doctor still? Is it too hard to become a doctor, or is it, or is the weed out culture still the right culture?
Well, so to get into medical school is exceptionally difficult. And I think one of the things that we have seen is a significant increase in both the number of medical schools as well as the size of the medical school classes. And I think that that does need to continue to grow. And then, you know, you've referenced a couple times the people who go to medical school internationally and then come here for training. Obviously, a huge piece of our GME footprint. And I think that is an opportunity that we have to grow more and make it easier for people to who want to stay here, who, you know, want to make this their new home, make it easier for them to know that they're going to have a place to be. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question on something you had just said, because what's happened is over the last 10 years, you hit this right on. There's been the growth in the number of medical schools in the country, and that obviously is just much needed. I mean, you see institutions like Banner, like Kaiser, like Carilion, a whole number of them in New Jersey as well, Hackensack, understanding we just need more medical schools. We just need them, and so to relieve some of that pressure and to help solve a problem. But what I'm told is more often the challenge city becomes not getting into medical school, which is still, you know, quite hard, and people inadvertently weed themselves out without realizing they're going to be great. But then it's getting residency spots too. Can you talk for a moment about the, you know, what that situation is between medical spots, school spots, and residency spots? Sometimes here there's not enough residency spots. Other people tell me there are enough. There's not in the specialties everybody wants. Can you shed some insight on that?
Yes. So it's probably both. You know, the residency slots, and this is what I was referencing, you know, the CMS funded reference residency slots are capped, and they're capped from, you know, decades ago. And so everything above and beyond that relies on other funding, either self-funded or state funding. And so, you know, the absolute number of residency slots funded by Medicare, which is the primary way that GME is funded in this country, hasn't kept up. And it's only going to get worse as the demand goes higher. Along with that is that the distribution of kinds of slots is also misapportioned for what we really need. And so it's both and that we're really facing the issues with.
Yes, fascinating. And talk about, as you've taken on this role in Loyola Medical Center, is a magnificent institution and one of the best transplant places in the country. Banner Healthcare and what Banner's done in partnership there, magnificent. And Banner's been one of the great success stories in our country over the last decade plus. Talk about what you're most excited about over the next 12 to 24 months. And obviously, part of this is getting through this national nightmare that is an international nightmare that is COVID. What are you excited about as you look into the future?
Yeah, so I'll just say, and, you know, today is a day where the first vaccination of a Pfizer vaccination went in a patient outside of a trial. That is the thing that I am most excited about is there's light at the end of this tunnel. And, you know, the speed at which these vaccinations have come to market has just been phenomenal. So far and away, that's it. That is the most excited thing. The second thing I would say is I think that there are many things that we have learned over these past 8 months about how we can operate differently that I am very excited about taking forward. So first off, you know, really partnering with our community between, you know, competing providers and our public health departments and elected officials in ways that we haven't done before. You know, we're still going to be in competition for many things, but there are many opportunities where I think we can provide better health and safety by collaboration rather than competing. I think how we lead has been fundamentally changed. We make decisions faster. We communicate better. And as I talk to people around the country, many people have felt the same thing. And so we're going to continue that as well. I think the use of technology, certainly telehealth, is You know, we had talked about it for a long time, and places have done it little bits here and there, but it's now part of our business. We, you know, in 3 months, we went from, you know, less than 5% of visits through teletechnology to 40%. You know, I think we'll probably settle out somewhere in the 20-25% range, but that never would have happened so fast. Thinking about supply chain systems fundamentally differently, those are all things that I think we can take away from, you know, the pandemic that I'm actually really excited to transform how we live differently. I think the other piece is I think there's going to be new opportunities to, you know, grow our business through partnerships with community providers who may look at a big health system a little bit differently today than they would have a year ago. And for that, I'm looking forward to what that brings as well.
Fantastic. Well, just a, Chad, great pleasure talking today. A remarkable career, remarkably thoughtful. Dr. Whalen, thank you so much for joining us, and continued good luck at Banner University Medicine. Fantastic.
Thank you.